Good afternoon and welcome to this special live broadcast from the Linda WAMC Northeast Public Radio's Performing Arts Studio. I'm Alan Chartok. We are gathered here in Albany as part of a month-long celebration of A City of Immigrants by arts and civics groups across the Capital Region. In conjunction with Albany Pro Musica, this series explores the cultural heritage of the Capital Region, WAMC, and its partner, the Albany Times Union. And sitting in the back of the room are Rex Smith and Mike Spain, and we want to give them a big hand for helping arrange. I have decided to deputize Paul Grondel, who is the real expert in this and has been doing a series of wonderful articles on the city of immigrants, and he'll take over from me right here. Thank you, Paul, for doing that.
You're welcome, Alan. It's really my pleasure and honor to be here at WAMC this afternoon. I'm going to start by introducing the three panelists, people who I've known. In the case of Mossy at the end, I play basketball with. I have a few bruises from him from last night, I think. But these three wonderful people will share some of their refugee and immigrant stories in a story that will appear this Sunday in the Times Union. But I'll start on my immediate left, Uzma Popel, who's the director of the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project, which is an amazing group that makes meals for homeless and refugee families, does large fundraisers of toiletries and school supplies and things that families really struggling and trying to get a start and a foothold in our community need. To her left is Francis Sengabo. He is the co-director, or rather operations director, of Refugees and Immigrant Support Services of Emmaus in Albany here. And each one of them have their own immigrant and refugee stories, which I hope they'll share. And to his left is Mossy Mukhtar, who's a graduate student in nanosciences at the University at Albany. And he came from Afghanistan, and he'll talk about that. But first, to set this up before I move to the panelists to let them share some of their personal stories, we've been writing the last week and beyond. I've been writing for many years about our immigration and refugee story here in Albany. We're here on Central Avenue, and if you knew this block 100 years ago, you'd be walking past bakeries and restaurants and shops that were started and settled by immigrants from Italy and Germany and Poland and Eastern European Jews and sort of the great wave of European immigration in the 19th century. If you look further down at the New York State Capitol, down the hill, built by Irish immigrants, many immigrants, stonemasons from Italy, etc., and even further back, we really exist as a community because it was Fort Orange and Beverwijk, which the Dutch colonists in the 17th century, who were willing to take a risk and come to this strange, you know, wild land across the Atlantic Ocean, settled and traded with the Native American groups for beaver fur. So we really are, across the history of four centuries and more, a city of immigrants. And when you talk to, as we will, some of the more recent arrivals, their struggles, their dreams, their aspirations, their successes are no different from the people I wrote about last week that you'll find at the American-Italian Community Center further up Central Avenue, or the American, or the rather the Irish-American Cultural Center down on Broadway in Albany, or you know many other groups that I talked to, the European immigrants. So it's really kind of a continuum, and the people are coming from different parts of the world today, often fleeing civil war, fleeing religious oppression, persecution, slightly different reasons for leaving. Many in the 19th century were for economic opportunity, but they're coming, leaving not by choice in most instances, and they're really working very hard to make a life for themselves and their families here. So let me start with Mossy. You told me a great story about you came here from Afghanistan after your family fled following a long Soviet occupation in your country. We can talk about more recent history because you're a great student of world history. But talk about when you arrived, your family, and here you are as a kindergartner, knowing no English, put in a classroom in Troy. Can you share that story?
Well, this is quite a bit ago, but some points of it is still very vivid in my mind because it's one of the formational memories that I have, and it's one of those things that stick with you and always help to keep your perspective grounded so that you understand the struggles of others and to be able to understand where you come from and where have you been. You know, at the young age, about 4.5, 5 years old, I ended up in the United States, more specifically in the capital region, with my immediate nuclear family. And I had never been to school before, so I was functionally illiterate. You know, I had older siblings who had gone to school in the refugee camps of Pakistan, so they knew a little bit, so they could understand to read and write, not in English, but they could at least do that. And for me, this was the first time I was going to be able to go to school, so I was very excited, anxious even, but I had no idea what that entailed, because I had never been to school, period. So for weeks prior to, I had been asking my mother, you know, I'm going to school, are you going to be there with me? I'm not going to be left alone, are you going to be there with me? And she'd assured me, you know, that she would. So she felt, if she assured me that by the time the deed was to be done, I would man up and would be okay with it. So that morning, walking to school, which was on 10th Street in Troy, where we live just a block down in 9th Street, walking that morning to school up the hill and standing outside the kindergarten classrooms with the rest of the families, I was, you know, I saw other parents. I thought it was a great idea. I thought, like, oh, look, all these guys are going to have their parents there too, and this would be a great time for me to see and meet people. And then I'll always have my safety blanket, my mother, in case I have, you know, anything come up. And, you know, a couple minutes prior to entering the room, I'm, you know, head on a swivel, asking my mother over and again, you're going to be there with me, right? And sure enough, she assured me that, sure, she would. And as soon as the door opened, you see the rest of the classmates enter in, but no parents do. And now I'm getting a little bit worried, but at the same time excited because I want to see what is inside this room that everyone is flooding into. And as soon as I walk in, I'm a bit awestruck because I've never been in a classroom and I've never seen so many toys and like trinkets and like posters on the wall. I was very curious in what it was. While I'm standing right at the door, I'm looking around, just awestruck, and then I hear smash, the door closed behind me. My mother's gone. And this is when I went crazy, essentially. I was wailing, screaming, kicking, you couldn't console me. And my poor teachers, they had no idea how to communicate with me. They had no idea what Pashto was or where I was from, and I had no idea on how to express myself in English except for crying as an infant. So what happened was they found that in the fifth grade, my aunt, who was my mother's youngest sister, was placed in fifth grade, a couple years below her actual level, which would be later fixed, but they called her down to try to calm me down, and that kind of worked, but I was still bursting out in hysteria from time to time. So what happened is we had a deal struck that my mother would sit in the back of the classroom for an entire week until I could get used to being in this new environment. And slowly but surely, that week of sitting in the back of the class during story time and constantly looking back and making sure that my mother was there, but realizing that I was okay just as I was, helped me progress into being a normal student.
And here he is, a graduate at the University of Albany, and now taking graduate courses in nanosciences. A tremendous. And he talked about the learning curve. Go ahead, you can applaud. This is, and we'll move to Francis next, who's working with families just like Masi's family. The biggest barrier is language. And it's much easier on a young child. He talked about, yeah, I remember going to a few classes at school, and then all of a sudden it clicked, and I knew English, and I don't really remember now not knowing English, but maybe Francis could talk about, he came from war-torn genocide in Rwanda, lost his father and family members, spent a decade in a refugee camp in Tanzania, and made his way to Albany, and now works with refugee families, helping them learn English and other support services. But maybe you could share your experience and talk about what is it that how people here could help, or what do new arrivals need most?
Thank you. I left my country in 1994 during the genocide. I was working for international Committee for Red Cross from Geneva, who this organization deals with internal displaced in the country, because the war started in 1990. I'm coming from the West, and I was working in the East. This means during the war, my parents went in Congo, and me, I went in Tanzania. I never met them again. In a refugee camp, you know, there's no infrastructure, there's no schools, there's no houses, there's no, only it starts from zero, I say from the bush. The first refugee camp I was, it was around 400,000. It was from different countries. This means Burundi, Rwanda, some from Uganda, and Sudan. UNHCR, who is dealing with the refugees, they separated according to the country. In the beginning, it was chaotic because they're distributing the food you know, they put food there. Anybody who can get the food could go and get the food. I observed that only people who were able to get food is those people who are young, who has energy, those kids, those women who are pregnant, the old people, they could not get food for 2 weeks. Many people died in refugee camp. And that's one problem. The second, it was to get service, it was hard because in Rwanda, we speak in Rwanda, people who went to school, they speak French. In Tanzania, the language is the Swahili, where I was speaking with the Masihi. So it was a big struggle. During the organization, you know, to set up the refugee camp and I was helping because, but it was hard to, because they did not speak Swahili. After 2 or 3 months, you know, the camp was set up and UNHCR started to, you know, to provide service, to provide the water, food, medication, and the other assistance. After 1 year in 1995, they removed me from the big refugee camp to little refugee camp because it was a security issue. Where, because my father was a political leader, so I could not deal with the people who were maybe against him or him against them. In refugee camp, it was 1,500. This refugee camp was composed by people from Burundi who have the same problem, Uganda, and Somalia. Again, it was another problem because we could not communicate. But at that time, I was able to speak a little bit of Swahili. I stayed there until 2002, where they removed me again in another refugee camp, where this refugee camp generally is there for those people who cannot go back in the country for different reasons. I stayed there until 2007, where I was selected by United States of America to resettle here. I came here in March, I remember 2007, it was so cold. When I got at the airport, the agents, the settlement who came to receive me at the airport, the guy was from Congo, speaks Swahili, French, English, and Kinyarwanda. And the first question I asked him, I say, you know, is it possible to move to another area where it's not cold like this? He told me, you know, don't worry, you will set up and, you know, they drove me to my apartment at Dana Avenue. And, you know, everything was new. Because in my country, we don't have a fridge because the climate, it's moderate. We don't have, those stuff, the modeling toilet. And I remember my brother, he told me that, the first 2 weeks, he could not get a shower from the because he was, how can you get a basin in order to, to get a shower? So everything was new. And I remember United Methodist Church, the pastor speaks a little French. She came to visit me at my house. It was the first week, and because we get here, it was a Wednesday. USRI gave us food for Thursday, Friday. I think because they were busy, they forgot that we didn't have food. On Saturday and Sunday, we didn't have food. And the pastor came to visit. Generally, in our culture, we don't show our weakness. If we are hungry, we don't say. If we need something, we don't say. And she said, oh, there's the food? I said, oh, yes. But look at my face. She discovered that, she went through the fridge. The fridge was empty. Of course, she went to buy food. And again, she bought food. And one of the food that was hot dog. And, I look at her. I say, in America, the people eat dog? I wait until she left, and when she left, we throw away. So she invited me with my family to go to church. Everybody was, speaking English. I could not speak, and I could only communicate with her because only her who speak a little French. At the third week, I think I tried to get the bus. USRI was at Westgate, the office was at Westgate. And I got the bus and, with my $10, the bill for $10. In our country, we give the driver money. So when I went the bus, I handed my $10 bill to driver. Driver was looking at me like, I didn't know how to put the machine, I could not communicate with him, but he discovered that I'm not able to speak. And I showed him, I go out, like showing like this. He said, oh, stay. And when I get to Westgate, I got out and I went to the office. I told them the story, what happened? Oh, they say, that's how you need to learn English as soon as possible. From there, pastor started to teach us English in through the Bible. That's how I started to learn English. Maybe you'll give me time to talk more. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Francis. Before we move to Uzma, I want to give a brief perspective. Last week at Rockefeller Institute, an official from the United Nations was there whom I interviewed, and there's been a lot of focus on a few million people in desperate straits in Europe in the migrant crisis and how the EU is trying to deal with it, and many people are dying in crossing to Greece, but there are 60 million people right now around the world who are displaced, on the move, without a home, struggling. And each year in Albany, we take 400 of those people. And as a country, we take 70,000. So the people on this panel today are incredible in terms of their family drive, their ambition, their effort to get here and to succeed. The numbers are incredibly stacked against them. They're 1/1,000th of 1% who get to this level. So we're looking at superstars here. And I'm reminded that when I interview people, especially English as a second language teachers who've worked 40 years with new arrivals, and say, you have to realize that the people that are here in Albany are exceptional. So I'll introduce Uzma Popol, and she might start briefly with sharing when she came as a young child from Pakistan, and her father worked three jobs to support her family of seven. And then she can talk about the great work that the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project is doing to help other new arrivals. Uzma?
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I really am grateful to be here. I realize that there's so much against us, but I'm really happy that I'm part of this. Now, when I came here, it was my parents brought us here for a better education, for better opportunities. And when we came here, I did cry for a little bit, for a few days, and that was not because I missed my relatives. It was because I had to leave my cat behind. So that was sad. But when we came here, my first sentence I remember was my dad teaching us, sitting around the dinner table, he wanted us to practice English. So my first sentence was, please pass the water. And when I came here, I think it was in August, and soon after in September, in 1985, I saw my first snowflake. I had no idea what that was. We went outside, my brothers and sisters, we had a lot of fun out there without jackets, then realized it was too cold, and we came back in. So growing up here, coming here, we didn't know any English, but my dad knew the English, so he helped us. And he's my hero. He worked so hard with seven kids. He could have applied for food stamps and everything, but he didn't. He believed, you know, he has two hands, he's going to use them, and he wanted to set a good example for his children to work hard. So he worked three jobs, and he made all of us kids go through college, go through all the school, everything, all by himself. And that left a real... I'm so proud of him. He's my hero. And my mom, she was there with us every morning. She would have seven lunch bags ready for us. And she was so kind, and still she's so kind and generous, and I learned so much from both of them. And perhaps that's why I'm into the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project so much, is because of the mix of them, the hard work that goes into it, and being nice and generous to other people, seeing where their needs are. And that's why I joined MSKP a couple of years ago, because my kids were getting older and I wanted them to participate and be part of the community and learn to appreciate things around them. In Muslim Soup Kitchen, we do this every once a month, last Saturday of every month, where we... A couple of years ago, we used to do 35, 240 meals a month, but now we do like 300 to 500 meals every month. And we have at least 17 shelters around the Capital District that we help. And we, as he said, we have... What motivated me to have the bi-monthly drives was I talk to the shelters and I find out what their needs are. So they have a lot of... help, but when it comes to protein, meat, or fresh fruit, a lot of homeless or families that need them, they don't have these kind of things, and we take it for granted. We eat every day, and we waste, and these people, they don't have that. So I started doing them by monthly drive, and last year we raised over 2,000 pounds of meat and distributed it to local families and local shelters. And we do that every other month. I mean, we don't do this by ourselves. There's a whole team of people that help us. And we partner with lots of nonprofit organizations to make it happen. For example, Zakat Foundation. That's another... one that has helped us. They donated freezers, which one freezer we put into a store. And when people buy their meat, they buy a portion of it and donate it. And that's how we keep track of it, and we donate it to local shelters so they can continuously have meat. I mean, this is not just a soup kitchen. there's so much more to it. It's creating unity through helping those in need. And it's not just creating unity through, you know, with people and the shelters. It's about family. Families come together and they bond and they help and they have fun and realize, you know, there's people out there that need them. It's not just about us. There's many events that take place in Mustang Soup Kitchen, but there's one particular one that I really want to share with you, and it's the first annual National Muslim Soup Kitchen Day. And that day, April 30th, we want all organizations, Muslims, non-Muslims, everyone to come together and feed those in need in your community. And thinking about ending world hunger may seem like a difficult task, but it is possible. There's always a beginning to everything. And I think if we can end hunger just for one day on April 30th by getting together, that would be a step towards ending world hunger.
Wonderful. Thank you, Uzma. I'll ask a few questions, and I know we'll have time for possibly some of your questions as well. But when I report stories like this, I always try to put myself in the shoes of the people that I interview, and it's a little difficult, although I've had great opportunities to travel pretty widely around the world, and I've been in a lot of developing countries. And I just think of, went to Malawi several years ago with the Times Union for a project, and it's one of the poorest and smallest countries in Africa and the whole world, actually. And you know, when we got on that plane and lifted off, I was grateful, one, for the incredible privilege and what we have in this country, but thinking, like Mossy, if they dropped me off there, I'd be crying for my mom. I was like, how would I survive? I don't know the language. I'm out in this hot, you know, area in these poor villages, and it's really difficult. The median age of the mortality rate, rather, was 37 years old when we were there. And I'm thinking, what if I got dropped in one of their countries? Where would I be in 3 years or 5 years? Would I have, you know, be studying for a graduate degree in nanosciences, or be running this great soup kitchen project, or operations director for this great agency? I don't think so. So I think we need to be reminded and sort of look at ourselves if we were in that situation. And this great concert that's going to culminate this on April 3rd with Albany Pro Musica's City of Immigrants is a celebration, and these articles are meant to celebrate, but I do want to ask about the dark side, and I'm sure there's been ugly incidents in all your lives.
And before you do, I just want to remind all of our listeners what you're listening to here. A part of a month-long celebration of a city of immigrants by arts and civics groups across the capital region. And we're very grateful to Paul Grondel, who you're listening to, and to all of our participants today. Paul, you've done an amazing job here.
Thank you, Alan. I'm sorry, you did deputize me, so I'm kind
did.
Of usurping the... But
not
do you have
all.
A question in here?
No.
Okay. So I do want to acknowledge that it's not all sweetness and light for the new refugees and immigrants, and if it doesn't make you uncomfortable, could you share any instances of discrimination, bullying, anything, and what we could learn from that, and what you learned from it, and I'm sure you still think of the hurt if it did happen to you. Mossy, do you have anything to share?
Like Paul mentioned earlier, when I first came to America and I started going to kindergarten, I did have to go to ESL, and that was a period during the day. And honestly, I believe it might have been like a 6 month to 8 month stretch where I went from knowing no English to not remembering not knowing English. It was that quick. It was surprising to me, even today, how quickly that turned around. But that did not help as much with the cultural progress. Now, I might have known how to speak English, but that doesn't mean that I was in with everyone else, or that I had the same cultural cues that everyone else understood because of how they were raised at home. There were many times, and I mean, when I was young, especially elementary school and throughout, that I just got into so many fights because people just wanted to pick on the outsider. That's really what it was. Part of it could have been maybe there wasn't enough education in the home. Actually, that might be a really big part of it, because even the parents probably had no idea who these immigrants were, and they're struggling with their own problems at home. And then you have, you know, somewhat lackadaisical, maybe just completely unaware teachers who couldn't understand what the issues really were. But there was a lot of times in which I had to get into fist fights or scraps in the, you know, during recess or right outside of school or even in front of my house, because there were times in which if you started a fight with someone simply because they're an outsider, and maybe they didn't win, but guess what? They had a whole group of friends that would come after you later. And that happened quite often. You know, there, I remember one particular moment where I was just walking back from school by myself, and I couldn't have been more than second or third grade. And what happened, there was a group of kids behind me, and I could hear them murmuring. And they sent out a much younger child, maybe 4 or 5 years old, to come over and bother me. And as soon as I would try to keep that child away from hitting me or push me around, they would attack me. And that's exactly what they did. I could hear them murmuring. I could kind of understand that something was going down, but I was close to home. And what happened was, as soon as I tried to keep the young child away from me at bay, I just got punched in the, you know, I got sucker punched in the eye. And I got hit a couple of times, and they all just ran. And this seems to be, I mean, an ongoing theme. And even if you keep up the social media now, kids are just doing ridiculous things that should be nipped in the bud. From the home, from school, but most especially in the home, there should be some type of sit down and talking to among children and their parents to let them know that just because someone is different, does it give you the right to do anything physical or even verbal? I mean, we have freedom of speech, but that doesn't mean you need to open your mouth. but this is just one incident. And what happened is that I learned from this. And in a lot of ways, it's made me a hardened person. Sometimes I think maybe I should, you know, be a little bit more soft and patient. But these experiences in my life have always kept me with my head on a swivel. And maybe these are the experiences of growing up in 9th Street, Troy, that really helped me during my time in Peace Corps, 3 years in Tanzania, in which I'm always watching my back. And there are times where people try to rob me on the street or do something, but because I was well aware what's going to happen, it didn't happen.
I forgot to mention, Masi spent time in the Peace Corps in Tanzania and actually worked, stayed in the country afterwards and did some amazing work. How about Francis? Anything not so nice happened to you when you came to Albany?
you know, as a refugee, to come in this country where you were not able to talk to anybody, faced with a shock, because first, you know, in Africa, we live in a community where the community, you know, is aware of what's going on. When I was at Dan Avenue, I remember that I could not talk to neighbor. So you don't even, you know, they didn't know even who is in the apartment. My landlord, it was a Chinese, and he had the same problem with me, but, you know, I remember one day the school bus left my daughter at home, and I was thinking that maybe I could, you know, it was called, you know, get somebody who can help me to bring her to school. When I called school, you know, by broken English, you know, the school told him, the secretary, we cannot understand what are you talking about. And she hung up. When I was in Africa, they said, you know, if you're not, you are in the U.S. and you cannot bring your child in school, we will go in jail. And I said, I accepted to go in jail rather than to walk in the cold. You know, I work with refugees on a daily basis. You know, there's many incidents in schools where we have after school program. our executive director, she's there, she can tell more about the children we have in after school program. Majority of them, they don't speak English. Whenever they come from school, they're frustrated, shocked. Because the school system here is, in ESL class, they spend 2 hours only per day. What other 5 hours or six, they don't understand anything. So they are idle, they don't know anything. That's one point. The second is refugees from different culture. I remember I went with one refugee from Middle East, and you know, there is a form to fill, you know, those questions. Your identity, are you this? And there's the question to say that, are you pregnant? And she was looking at me like, I told you I'm single. How I can be pregnant? I don't have a husband. She was very upset. Whenever I ask such a question, I ask those questions carefully, because sometimes I hurt them, and it's normal. I remember, you know, when you, for example, you need to make an appointment, they need to pay medical bill, or they have Medicaid, and the hospital will say, we cannot give you information, we need to talk to the person. I say, here he is. Now I hang the phone, and they cannot talk. This is kind of a shock, because sometimes refugees, they don't get right service because of language barrier.
Thank you, Francis. Uzma, do you have anything to add?
You know, I'm sitting here and I'm going through my childhood and up to now thinking, what has happened to me? And actually, nothing. nothing bad, alhamdulillah, thank God. I've always been lucky. I've always been around so many wonderful people. When I came here, I went to Waterford Half Moon School, and that school was so wonderful. The teachers were great. The students, they were very curious about me, but never judging me. And I really love that. That they were good. And going to college, I remember that's when I started to wear my scarf. And one of the students who had seen me, I mean, from my school, came up to me, and I was kind of hesitant to wear my scarf, wondering what people would say, what people would think. But she saw me, and I said, yeah, I'm wearing a scarf. And she said to me, she goes, hey, at least it keeps you nice and warm in the winter. So these are the kind of people that were around me, and I love that. Even up to now, I've only met even more wonderful people. When I got into the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project, I thought the best part about it would be to helping others, to feel good that you're making a difference. But actually, the best part for me was meeting so many wonderful people out there. They're there for the same cause. They're trying to help people. So many wonderful people are out there. And I think we need to focus on all the wonderful people that are out there. And then last is, now that I'm working at the Muslim Community Center, and I'm helping them create and direct a summer camp that will begin in July 11th. And the whole team, we're working together so hard to make this happen, and it's free to all, you know? It's not just for Muslims, it's for everyone, for all kids. And I'm just lucky to be part of all this.
That's great. I want to add a little historical perspective and we'll move on to another question. I do think we've made a lot of progress, despite I hear often kids getting bullied in school because they're different. But I also hear from the adults that I speak with at Francis's program and at USCRI, the U.S. Committee of Refugees and Immigrants, which has resettled 3,100 people in this community since 2005, is the isolation. When your language skills are you know, really rudimentary, they talk about the sacrifice they're making for their children. They often feel isolated, have a hard time getting a job, cannot communicate as well out in the community. So there's a sense of isolation, but there's a great improvement from 1850 when I started doing some research. From 1850 to 2010, the best kind of analysis and data we could find, and again, it's difficult because the question wasn't always asked on census forms, but foreign-born, roughly a million people in this Albany, Schenectady, Troy area since 1850, and come from over 75 countries. But I was looking at 1850, and we used to have the Albany Almshouse. This was before there was any social safety net, and it was a horrible place, a warehouse, essentially, for the marginalized and destitute up on New Scotland Avenue across from Albany Medical Center today. It's long gone, it's been shut down since 1928, but in that year, 1850, there were 1,380 people placed there. And if you were mentally ill, if you were disabled, if you were quote unquote feeble-minded, if you had intemperate habits, as they termed it, meant you were alcoholic, you were placed in there. And there's a vast graveyard of people who had no family and died young and of horrible diseases who were buried there, over 2,400 people that were later moved to Albany Rural Cemetery, which is how I found out about it. But I looked at those 1850 ledger books, and out of those 1,380 people who were put in this horrible, horrible warehouse, 1,275 were foreign born. And you start reading, they have brief entries, many uneducated, illiterate young women from Ireland who could not support themselves, were essentially begging on the streets, were dropped in there, and often died a short while later of some kind of, you know, tuberculosis or communicable disease, and on and on and on, page after page of people who came from these difficult situations in Europe and ended up here and died a horrible, sad, isolated, you know, death. And I think we've come a long way from that. The people that I'll write about and the Sunday story include college graduates and people who have good jobs raising their family here. So I want to talk about what was, in each of your situations or your family, was there a critical point? Was it learning language? Was it getting education? Was it finding a job? What you know, got you over the hump to success, do you think? I'll start with Masi.
I think my family story is very similar to the traditional immigrant story of America, where the parents, once they immigrate with their children who become the first generation, really work it out and tough it out until their kids are older enough to leverage what they've learned about the culture and the system to be able to start living the American dream, the quote-unquote American dream. And I think that's what happened with us. You know, our parents just worked. Our nuclear family, my maternal grandparents and aunts and uncles, similar story. They just had to grow in the system, learn the language, culture, and get trained in any particular field so they could finally leverage out into something more, because it's just hard for any family to take care of so many children and dependents and advance at the same time. You can only manage most of the time, and you can only keep your head above water for so long. And that's what a lot of the immigrant stories in America have always been about: working hard, keeping it together for your children, so that they can use whatever they learned that is pertinent to the system that they've grown up in to advance the family name, the trade, whatever that may be.
Francis?
I was lucky because when I arrived here, United Methodist Church pastor asked me if I can write her a proposal in order to see if the church can help. At that time, were a few refugees from Rwanda and the Congo. So I wrote a little proposal, because in refugee camp I was a principal for middle school. And I told her that what we need immediate is how we can learn English in order to be successful, to work on the feet. You know, the church started ministry to teach us English, and we discovered that the kids need to be somewhere where the parents are learning English during summer. So from there, I start to work on a project for we called low income population. That where we started to work on this on the project, and we got support from the church until 2010, where it was recognized as a non-profit organization, Refugee and Immigrant Support Services. Like now, we are providing service for around 200 families in Albany, and some of them are from Lanseria or Schenectady. And also, we have around 100 kids who are coming for every day to get help for homework and to deal with other problems on daily basis. But again, I came with my two brothers. You know, one, he preferred to go in college, and he went in the program of cardiovascular. When he was about to graduate, he discovered that in order to work, he need to communicate with doctors. But he has this limitation in English. In class, he was well, but he could not work. He changed the program to go in nursing. Now he has two associate degrees, one cardiovascular, another registered nurse, but he's using one. That's one experience. You know, when you have limited English, that you have in even limited opportunities. Second, when kids they go to school, as Masi said, it's very, very hard for children who come here over 15 years old. It is very hard to make any school. Since 2007, until now, because there is a big difference for refugees who come from the city and others who come from the village. It's a big difference because those who come from cities, they went to school. Those who end, they know, you know, they can get this and that. But those who come really in the village, it's very hard for them. We have only until 2007, those who come from the village, two girls who graduated, they have bachelor degrees. Others, after high school, it's very hard to make it. That's why even last week I was talking to Urban School District that how this system can be improved for the young kids who come over 15 years old, how you know they can make it in order to succeed in school. Job, you know, it is very hard. I bring people to find a job. We have a relationship with different companies, hotels, restaurants. The big problem, again, it's language. If the parents has a job, maybe in a hotel, he has an appointment, it's hard to communicate with the employer so that, you know, my son or my daughter has an appointment, I will not go to them. What they do is to stay home or to go to appointment. And the next day when you go, the manager will be upset because this person didn't want to go to work. I remember one incident. I brought one of our client to interview in hotel, and you know, he passed the interview, it was well, good, and the manager asked him, do you have any question? And I said, oh, yes. He said, if somebody will die in my family, what I will do? And the manager said, here or back in your country? He said, back in my country. Because in their country, if somebody died in your family, the whole family doesn't go to work. They will stay home. And he said, oh, what you will do? He said, you know, I will stay home. I will not come to work. He lost that job because of that answer. So it's struggle. You know, job, it's, of course, there is people, they start to be familiar with the refugees because we communicate with them. If maybe they have appointment, they come to me, I will call the manager, we, you know, schedule. But it is very, very hard. We have other incident, you know, in recycling, you know, they have, they put stuff on a conveyor belt. I don't know if it's the right vocabulary. In recycling.
Recycle bin.
Recycle bin, yeah. They have this conveyor belt. Mm-hmm. We bring them, you know, to orientation, where they have to see those videos, how incident can happen. Because it was very cold, one guy from Sudan, where the machine was stopped, he went on the conveyor belt, started to hit his hand on the, you know, and when the supervisor saw him, it was, he lost the job. Even if it was to go to orientation, because I think the experience showed that right now, the refugees who come in U.S., before maybe it was the people who were education, could, you know, flee the country because of political issue, but now even people who are low level education, they flee their country. That's one of the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And Uzma, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I didn't have the language issue because I was very young when I came, so I picked up really well. But I did have one thing that we all deal with the different culture. The different culture at home when our parents, they grew up just like they did back home. Same food, same clothes, same everything. And when we go outside of school, we see so much different culture. And I think us growing up, I felt trapped. Like, where do we belong? Who am I? And we had to deal with that really early. And I didn't realize till after I was married with a couple of kids and realized, you know what? It doesn't matter. What matters is who I am right now. You know, so it's once you stop thinking about putting yourself in a place where you think you should be and just realizing it's okay to be different, you just be comfortable with who you are, and I think that's where, after that, that's where I started to, you know, get better at what I'm doing and have my confidence.
Great. And I'll share one more kind of happy ending to a unfortunate incident. Rifat Filkins is here. She's the director with Francis of the Refugees, Immigration, and Support Services. And they're building on West Lawrence, a few miles from here in Pine Hills, was destroyed by an arsonist who also slashed the tires on their two vans that Francis uses to bring families to classes and to help them out. The investigators never solved it. Nobody was definitively able to label it a hate crime, but it was a horrible setback for a group that really works hard and struggles by donations and volunteers. But through over a year of hard work and dealing with the insurance company and everything, the restoration is almost complete, and Rifat just told me at the beginning that they're having a grand reopening on March 28th, later this month. So that's
April.
What's that?
April.
I'm sorry, yeah, we're in April. Sorry, April 28th. Not this month, next month. That's great news. I think we have a few minutes more if there was somebody with a quick question for our panelists.
They've been that's going to be difficult because we don't have a microphone set up, Paul.
Is it? Okay.
But let me ask you a personal question to you.
Yeah.
You obviously have an incredible passion about this subject.
Yeah.
What specifically led you to that?
I don't know. I mean, I like human interest stories and people stories, and I always like stories where somebody starts at the bottom or an underdog and succeeds and overcomes barriers and challenges. And we're all immigrants. I mean, I know you have an immigrant story. Everyone in this room does. My grandmother came from Norway in the early 1920s and cleaned bathrooms and rooms at the University of Washington. And I'm from the Northwest, and she settled there in this enclave of Norwegian, essentially fishermen. And we'd go every Sunday to supper at her house, and all these Norwegian people would be there and spoke Norwegian and ate Norwegian food and this little enclave, and I still remember that. And they worked very hard coming from a country that was very poor and nothing for them there, and earned their way in this little corner of the Northwest. And I think so many people forget that, two, three, four generations past. You forget what it was like, you know, showing up in a strange place. I see it all the time when I travel. Was in Turkey with the Turkish Cultural Center of Albany at the end of August. Brought my daughter, who's a college student, and it was an amazing experience. And I was so glad to have these wonderful Turkish guides with us, because when you travel to a foreign country, a far-off land, you realize that it'd be very difficult to start from scratch here. So I think those stories of people who overcome things always interest me.
Paul, I wonder if you'd do us a big favor, and because people join later, and go through the panel and just tell us who's here that they've been listening to.
We have Uzma Popol, who's the director of the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project, Francis Sangabo, operations director, Refugees and Immigrant Support Services of EMEAS, known as RISE, and Masi Mukhtar, who's a graduate student in nanosciences at the University of Albany.
Well, this is incredible. We haven't mentioned Donald Trump once during
this. I was trying to keep the name out, but he's a subtext in all of this.
And I think that is the subtext. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to a wonderful forum put together by Paul Grondahl, who's done a terrific job of writing. This is a part of a month-long celebration of a city of immigrants by arts and civics groups across the capital region in conjunction with Albany Pro Musica and examining the cultural heritage of the capital region. I would be again, I wanted to thank the Albany Times Union for co-sponsoring today's forum. They really are wonderful. They've been very, very helpful. Paul, I wanted to ask you very quickly I want to give you one more chance to tell us about the concert.
Yes, the concert is April 3rd, Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, Albany Pro Musica, a city of immigrants. And I was drafted for this assignment by our editor, Rex Smith, who sings with Albany Pro Musica.
Not surprising.
And has a long association with WAMC, and it's nice to partner with WAMC. But again, I'm really here because our three people on our panel are remarkable people. And in reporting this series, I've met remarkable people from all over the world.
Well, Paul Grondahl, thank you very much. Audience, thank you very much for coming. I'm Alan Chartok. We'll see you all soon.